Welcome back to the Physician Syndicate podcast. I am your host, Greg, and today we have another special guest, another physician founder that's coming on the podcast to share a little bit about building companies and some of their knowledge. So welcome to the show, Dr. Jenny Schneider, who's the CEO and co-founder of Homeward, which we'll definitely jump into. But Jenny, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Delighted to get to have a chance to connect with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Of course. So let's jump right into kind of a little bit on your background, your clinical career, kind of where you came from, and then eventually ending with how the heck you got into the startup world to begin with.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I am a middle child, an older brother and a younger brother. Grew up in the southeast corner of Minnesota in a town called Winona, Minnesota, with no healthcare really in my family. My dad runs an auto parts store that his dad started, my grandpa, when my grandpa dropped out of high school to feed a family of 10. And I really got interested in healthcare when I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 12. And that is a condition, as we all know, that requires a lot of participant involvement. So I got acquainted with the healthcare system fast and furiously going into my teenage years, and then became a physician.
Perfect. Yeah, my family actually, they weren't from Minnesota, but they were from Rossall, South Dakota, which I think is just over the border somewhere by Minneapolis, maybe. I'm not sure. That's interesting. And so where did you actually train then? Where were you for med school, residency, all of that jazz?
Great question. Well, I want to pause for just a second because sure. South Dakota going to Badlands was where my dad took us on every summer vacation. So that was a high point.
Oh, nice.
Growing up as well. So growing up in Minnesota, I actually ended up going to college at Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. And then I transitioned to medical school in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins University. And then I did my residency at Stanford in internal medicine.
Got it. Okay. And so after your internal medicine residency, how long were you practicing before you got involved with startups?
Right. So after my residency, I took a chief year. So I stayed on as junior faculty at Stanford. And then I applied to do two different things. One was an infectious disease fellowship at Stanford, and the other one was an EIS, Epidemiology Intelligence Service Officer at the CDC. And I got accepted to both and declined both, and instead decided to go back and more schooling and get a master's in health services research. And at that time, it was really an awakening and an awareness that I loved medicine, but what I really loved was the ability to teach other people and collaborate in groups. And I wasn't as interested in pigeonholing myself into academics and really had an opportunity to stay in the Bay Area to go back to Stanford. And it was really when I was at Stanford, taking a bunch of classes in the business school around population and data and how do we answer larger population questions and attaining the skills to do that, that I met somebody who was doing something that I thought was just super interesting. And at that time, it wasn't, I want to go get a job in the startup world. It was very much, here's a problem. And the problem is, how do we create a free market in healthcare? And there was a company at that time founded by a serial successful entrepreneur named Giovanni Colella. The company was called Castlight Health. And that was the premise for what Castlight was when it started. And Castlight ultimately led the way in establishing price and quality transparency, which seems pretty table stakes now, but at the time when we were building the company, it was very different. You know, so I jokingly say to my brother, who's an engineer at Apple, he's like, how did you end up into this technology world? I used to have to call him because I couldn't figure out how to go from one page of the Word document to the next when I was in college. He's like, the down arrow, Jenny, the down arrow. But it was really, to me, was about solving a problem that was massive. And it was in that transition when I moved into Castlight that I started to actually see a whole new world where we could change healthcare at scale faster from a different angle. And so I fell in love with both the idea and concept of finding something that really mattered, that was really broken, building highly competent, engaged, mission-driven teams, and then watching the change take place in a much more rapid cadence.
So tell me a little bit then about transitioning from going into the startup world. I think you started at the director level and then worked your way up. So what was that like making that transition? Because there's a lot of physicians that are listening to this. Either they're interested in potentially switching over to a non-clinical role, whether that's in pharma, consulting, startups, or potentially building their own company. So what was that like for you? And were the people around you like, what are you doing?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And I'm sure like you spend a fair amount of my time speaking with people who are interested and curious about the switch. And for me personally, I think there is a lot of humble lessons as you make the switch. And I think the biggest one is medicine is very, very hierarchical. And so as you're in the learning process, you're not allowed to make decisions. Somebody else is ultimately responsible. And then when you become the attending, you are ultimately responsible. And so what you say actually has to happen. And in the business world, everything's a discussion, right? You don't get to just kind of give the answer because you're a doctor. So having come through training years and years of medical school residency, and you come out and you're like, wait, but that it should be this. The product should look like this. This is the word that should be used, like doesn't work, right? And so it's a much more collaboration experience. And I think looking around, I wasn't leaving clinical medicine. I was moving into something that was super interesting to me. And so I think that for people who are looking to make a change, I would ask yourself, like, is there something that's exciting to you? Are you moving into something or are you moving away from something? Because I think those really predicate the experience and the ability to be successful as you move into versus moving away from.
Yeah, I love that because, I mean, even for myself, building a company was never on my roadmap. And it was really just because we had an idea and we're like, oh, this is really an interesting thing like to delve into. And then it's like, you can't stop once you figure out that you're super interested in the space. Okay, so you went from director to chief medical officer at Castlight. So what was that like kind of rising up in the ranks of a company? And then ultimately you made the switch over, I think, was it to Livongo? Was that the switch over? Okay. So what was that like going from that to that?
Yeah. So I would say that I had really great mentorship and really great leadership and people who invested in me and taught me. So I was just very the good fortune of being surrounded by incredible mentors and a real interest, again, in solving a problem and being in the midst of what we were trying to solve. So as a middle child, I often say, like, I'll raise my hand and say I can do something, even though I don't even understand exactly what it is that I'm doing, but have been confident that I am as equipped as most people to be able to figure it out and will ask a lot of questions along the way. And so I think transitioning into leadership in that ecosystem, particularly with an MD training, is a lot about leaning in. It's a lot about saying, hey, I know you know that I went to medical school, I've got a fancy degree, but you know what? I've got a great marketing idea, or you know what? I can motivate a team and put together a cross-functional team so I can own data science and product and engineering and kind of sit across that. But it doesn't come naturally. It's not like someone's going to look at you and say, oh, because you went to Hopkins Medical School, you must therefore understand a business principle of how to go to market for new products, right? And so I think it's advice there would always be to lean in and to bet on yourself. And then for me, again, I'm a curvy path sort of person because I follow things that are interesting. And Castlight was interesting to me. How do you create a free market in healthcare? Again, no goal of joining a startup, getting into Silicon Valley, understanding technology, but learned so much in that process and got completely bit by the bug. And then I had another really interesting question come floating across my desk in the shape of Livongo as a company. And the question was, can we change people's behavior, people living with chronic conditions, can we change their behavior? And can we motivate them differently in the absence of like just being with them? Can we use the data to leverage insights and change behavior? And I, again, because I live with type one, like I fully understand that it's a motivational behavior, but it's like micro motivational moments consistently throughout the day. Like I'm sitting right now next to this container of semi-sweet chocolate chips. The question is, should I put a hand in to have a couple or not? Right. So that seems really silly, but there are real implications for my own healthcare journey. We have many, many micro moments. So when I moved over to Livongo, I was excited by the mission, super curious about the idea, and knew that I did not want to just be the chief medical officer. So I moved into chief medical officer role. Our business model was up and evolving, had just come off of what was then like the first unicorn IPO for a digital healthcare company in Castlight, selling into the employer space. So had learned a lot of really painful lessons by getting it wrong, you know, kind of took that with me, but also knew that at this new venture, I wanted to broaden my own sphere around what it looked like to run different parts of the business and grow the team.
So in the kind of history of Livongo, it was definitely before kind of the Teladoc Livongo merger that you came in. So where was Livongo kind of in their scaling when you arrived? Was it like kind of they're fully into growth, or were they still relatively early growth?
No. So I think we had like 50 members, you know, using the platform. We were really, really early into the growth, both from a membership standpoint and from a client standpoint. But got to be part of that and build the team to scale and to grow. So I started as chief medical officer in 2015. Livongo was formed at the end of 2014. So about a year in, kind of just starting to find product market fit from both a client and a user standpoint. And then transitioned into the role of president in 2018 to oversee engineering, product design, marketing, data science, and then corporate strategy, and then was a member of the team that took the company public for over $3 billion, and then ultimately did the transaction to Teladoc for $18.5 billion.
So that must have been wild to really have a front row seat from early, early stage all the way through an exit, ultimately through kind of another exit when you think about it, going from a public company and then merging with another gigantic company. But that's not really why you're here today. So we're going to talk more about Homeward. So where did this come from? How did this start? To set the table also for the listeners out there, we've talked about a couple venture capital firms, one of them being General Catalyst, which I think is one of the smartest venture capital firms in terms of how they're setting up their strategy to go after digital health and healthcare. The hospital I was at Jefferson, Stephen Klasko is now with General Catalyst, doing a lot of interesting work, doing a podcast as well. And the way that they're setting it up is honestly, I think the way that every venture firm should probably try to set it up, where they're creating partnerships with entrepreneurs, with physicians, but then also health systems. So give us a little bit of background. I know that you were an EIR, which we've talked a little bit about in this podcast, an entrepreneur in residence. How did that come about? And ultimately, how did the idea for Homeward form and then go in from there?
Yeah, maybe I'll just start with to underscore your sentiment. I think General Catalyst is one of the smartest investor groups out there. And groups are made up of people, right? They don't just exist without people in them. And so they have an incredible, diverse portfolio of people who I think slightly differently and are very dedicated to something that's transformative. So this idea around making big bets. And I think Hemant Taneja, whom most people in the space know and understand, I think is exceptional. And I had the honor and privilege of getting a front row seat through the thick and the thin of it at Livongo with Hemant. So that was wonderful. And at the time of the transaction, through a lot of series of conversations, decided to leave. All four of us leaders at Livongo left when we did the transaction with Teladoc. And I joined General Catalyst because I believe and loved what the firm was doing and wanted to spend a little time thinking about what next. And as I sat in the company and looked at different deals and met with different people, I kept trying to say to myself, like, what I want to do next has to be even bigger than where I just was. And that was the chronic condition management's huge, largest digital health deal ever in the ecosystem, huge, right? And I said, it has to be really broken. Like, I don't want to go do the same thing again. I want to do something and take a big swing, right? And so kept coming back to how broken healthcare delivery was in rural markets and how really that had been increasing over space and over time and not improving. So we know that there was 130 hospital closures in the last few years, and 30% of all hospitals in rural America are at risk of closing. Mortality, if you live in a zip code that's designated as rural in the United States, is 23% higher. 23% higher, independent of your socioeconomic status. And the dominant reason is access. And we've not been able to recruit physicians. We've continued in a fee-for-service world that does not reward the right actions. It is makes healthcare delivery really unsustainable in these rural markets. And so I kept bumping into that. And that's where I'm from. Like, these are, this is not theoretical for me. This is like, I grew up in rural Minnesota. This is my family. And sat down with Hemant and my co-founder, Mark Hendale, who was the chief product officer at Teladoc through the transition of that organization, and said, hey, this is a problem. Do we think we can do something differently? And what we came up with was yes. And so Homeward was born out of this goal around re-architecting the delivery of health and care in partnership with people in rural America. And the sort of the tenets that we built on, the two key core boulders were, number one, you had to take on the whole cost equation of healthcare delivery so that you could use the models that you needed to deploy that are different or have to be deployed differently at scale in rural markets versus urban. And let me pause for a second there and double click in that. So for example, it would be really great if you could monitor somebody's blood pressure, congestive heart failure on a regular basis. But if you look at the technology that exists, the technology works in a rural market, but the reimbursement structure for a doctor trying to stay economically afloat does not, unless you own that total cost of care and you're actually on the hook for all of the outcomes and you can make the right interventions. Otherwise, as a physician, you're not incented to stay in business. In fact, if you're providing the right types of care, you end up going out of business. And so like if the goal was to stay in business and increase access, we had to like change the economic model, right? So that was one. And there were companies that had started to do this, you know, at scale and larger places around managed care. So I'll use Oak Street Health, for example. But the second was that you had to do this to scale in rural markets where you can't, I use the phrase all the time, you can't staple a nurse to somebody because there are no nurses in rural markets and there's hardly any staplers, right? So you truly had to build on an infrastructure, a technology infrastructure to scale. Doesn't mean it's all tech, but it means like, how can we truly knock out those efficiencies and allow those care delivery models to work at scale? And so it was the combination of those two things and our belief that we could make a difference that led us down the path of launching Homeward.
Makes a lot of sense. So basically, you found another fantastic idea that you were passionate about and you're like, okay, this makes sense to go after. And that's honestly something we've talked about in the past too, is like, you look at some people like from the PayPal mafia, it's like a similar thing, right? Like they get one win, which then kind of unleashes their creativity to go out and do additional bigger and bigger and bigger things. When you look at like Elon Musk and David Sachs and all the PayPal mafia that have done crazy things. So it's kind of a similar situation where you combine forces with the people from one or two of the merged companies and you're like, here's the idea. Is this possible? And then you went out and actually did it. So that's fantastic. So how's it going?
I'm always amazed that when people get success, they're not braver. Like, again, it's like one, you've learned a lot. Like you have these scars from that last journey and they're so valuable because you're not going to make those same mistakes. You're likely to make bigger or different mistakes, but you're probably not going to make the same ones. And so this idea around, we have these entrepreneurs who are successful and retire because they made enough money to buy tuna sandwiches for lunch seems like such a waste, right? And so I'm always puzzled by these really talented people who withdraw versus taking even bigger swings, right? Because that's how we're going to ultimately transform the industry, is through a variety of really big swings. And not all of them will work, but in the process, we'll learn a ton and collectively we can move the industry forward.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You also look at serial entrepreneurs that start out with really small exits, that does kind of unbound them from thinking of, hey, I just need a successful exit. Like the Collison brothers had, I think it was like a $7 million sale of their first business, and then they go and build Stripe. Like it's one of the highest valued private companies in the world right now. So where are you guys in terms of how far along is Homeward? I guess, what year were you founded?
So we announced publicly in March of 2022. So we're about 14 months old.
Got it. Okay. And you've raised a fair amount of capital, mostly from General Catalyst, I believe, 50 million-ish, according to Crunchbase.
Yeah, 70 million, General Catalyst, Human Capital, and Arch Ventures. Great venture team.
Yeah, that's another thing we talk about too, is like having people on the cap table that you really, really want to have on the cap table, because that's like a marriage when you have those people actually join your board and stuff.
That's like that. And to be able to do that, I recognize, is an incredibly privileged position. So I understand that that's a privilege, but I say this, and I say this to the team all the time, I am so fortunate that we have not just the companies, but also like the directors that we have within those companies on our team, in terms of helping us think through and get to the next level.
So who from General Catalyst is on the board?
We have Hemant Asia, and we have Candace Richardson, who is a very, very strong venture person as well. So they're both wonderful. They work great as teams.
And so I know you guys are operating in Michigan and Minnesota right now. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So okay. When we launched in March of last year, and then in July, we announced a strategic partnership with Priority Health for access up to 30,000 lives in Michigan. And when we launched the company, we started in Medicare because that was the fastest path to that capitation, the financial arrangement in those markets that are managed care through the government. So we're able to do that. And then we subsequently announced this last April a partnership in Minnesota with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, which is delightful because we're in the state where my family lives, and my parents can now maybe understand a little bit around what my job is and what we're starting to do. But it's great to be in both of those places. And since then, we've been heads down, building the business, learning a ton as in early stages, working on high delivery of care. What we do know is our members absolutely love the service that we provide to them, and we continue to grow our membership base at a rapid clip.
And from what I've been able to read, it seems like you guys are doing kind of like a hybrid model where it's kind of like in-person clinic, but also virtual. How does that split look for at least early stage?
Yeah, it's a combination. We really, our model is we meet people kind of through three primary ways. One is in their home. Two is in the community, and we have mobile vans and mobile clinics that we can drive around and park with our partners to be accessible to individuals. And the third is continuously through technology. And it's really that combination. I joke all the time that telehealth has not solved healthcare access in rural America. Outcomes have gotten worse and telehealth prominence has gone up, right? So there's like a discrepancy there. And as we all know, and I think believe, it's a combination of touch, click and mortar, as you like to say. So like in-person touch and some virtual. And our investment in somebody in a rural market by being able to go into their house is like a game changer. It's a high investment, but what it does is allow us to truly understand what the drivers of the conditions are. So things such as someone who's had a recurrent falls, well, when you're in their house and you see the rugs or you see the 50 cats floating around, you start to understand what's causing those falls, right? And so you're getting at the root of the cause to be able to do that, to fix it. The second is that it just allows us to build trust differently so that the technology that allows us then to scale at a unit economic level is used. So if you ship a blood pressure cuff that's cellular connected to my grandma, like I guarantee you it is in her closet. If you go out there and introduce yourself and like have a story because you're local and you kind of share the same hairdresser or whatever, and you put your phone number into her phone, she will use that. Right. And so healthcare is personal. Healthcare requires intimate connections and trust. And building trust is really difficult to do just through technology. Yet technology is really important for us to be able to scale those services. So we do both. And then the third, like I said, is our mobile van or mobile clinic. And that's this idea that we can put that somewhere where people flow throughout their life. So people in rural America, they leave their house, like they go get groceries, like they buy shorts or, you know, the child down the street who's doing the basketball practice. But oftentimes those places where they go are very different, or going to buy shorts or groceries is a lot closer than going to the doctor's office 2 hours away. So in a mobile van, it frees us up, actually it untethers us to put some of the care delivery into places where people flow with their normal life. And it's an incentive to be able to increase access and take advantage of that.
I like that. That's a fantastic idea. And basically meeting people exactly where they are in the entire process. That's awesome. So where do you feel like you guys are right now in the process? So, I mean, you have had a front row seat to hyper growth, hyper scale at a couple different companies. You're still pretty early on, given you're 14 months in, basically. How do you feel like it's going? Do you feel like you're approaching product market fit? Is it basically, yeah, we're just waiting to scale to every other rural America city and town? Like, where does it stand for you in your mind?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And so I would say that I think we're like more advanced than most companies at this stage. And because I've done this now two times back to back with success, like I'd like to be even further advanced. But I think that we're, and it's great to have a board from that standpoint because they see, they pattern match, right? That's the job of a board is pattern match where you are. And I feel super grateful that we're funded, super grateful that we have two strategic partners and we'll end the year with many more. And we're deep in the market. And are we 100%? Is the product in the market 100%? Of course not. But is the learning at a pace that's going to get us there where we need to get there? The answer is yes. And so that's where I get a lot of calls from investors around, hey, we'd like to put money into, and I like with legitimacy, like, look, I am so busy. We're heads down learning.
And they'll do it.
Can't do it. Yeah. And but we're having a tremendous amount of learning in the market and it's super exciting.
That also gets investors like really excited. They're like, oh, I need to get the money in there. Just take it. Just take it.
But in this market for sure, like FOMO is your best friend.
Yeah. Like, especially with generative AI right now, it's insane. It is so funny. Oh. And I'm like, I don't know. Those incumbents are moving quite quickly since some of this generative AI stuff. I don't know what's going to happen. All right. So physicians that are listening have no idea what it's like to have $70 million in the bank. So if you can just quickly, like high level strategy, how the heck do you actually go towards, you have $70 million to, okay, I need to hire a bunch of people really quickly, potentially. I don't know what you guys did in terms of like hiring, where you're at right now in terms of employees, but like, what do you do when you get there and you're like, okay, we've raised a Series A, we've raised a Series B. What do you do? Like you are, if you're a new physician founder, and you happen to have the next generative AI company and you have $30 million in the bank, you're like, what the heck do I do now? So like from the CEO role, like what is your thought process? What departments are you hiring for first? And like, what is that thought process?
The thought process for me is pretty streamlined and maybe overly boring in that like I believe in frameworks and I actually really believe in the OKR framework. So objectives and key results every 6 months in an early stage company. And so like, what are the 3 to 5 things that you have to do in the next 6 months? And you hire against those objectives. And then you take your head up and those change and some you get wrong and some you overachieve and some you get spot on. And then you say, okay, for the next 6 months, what are the objectives that the business needs to grow to be able to be sustainable? What does that look like? And you have hard conversations and you have a couple trusted internal people that you run that path with. And then you hire in those areas to accomplish those goals. I think that is the focus that's required in early stage of business is truly holding yourselves accountable to metrics and not just kind of winging it all over the map. There's a lot of winging it like across the whole ecosystem, right? And that's true for us too. I think that's true in early stage. But I think having a focus around what it is you're trying to accomplish. And then the second part I would say is that especially in early stage, ensuring that you're reserving some for experimentation or learning above and beyond those metrics that you're trying to hit. And not like some, not like 2% of the global budget, but like probably like 10 to 20% of what your spend is in the early stages, Series A, Series B. Because you have to make sure by the time you're ready to scale the bejesus out of it, like that you have the right thing. Because if you scale something that's not right, ooh, that's really painful and really costly. And so like you could be 80% right, but those experimentations around the tinker side are going to make you like kind of be the winner when you're right, ready to go to scale.
And from like the perspective, again, of the CEO as the founder and a physician founder, how do you think about additional fundraises? Like, is that something that you're always thinking about? So you're like, hey, we're going to have to probably raise a Series C, a Series D, or are you building the company in a way that you might not need to go out and raise additional capital given the macroeconomic environment? How do you think about that?
So I think your job as a CEO is like, that's your number one job is to ensure that you can get funded to continue the growth and the trajectory, the runway of your company. That's your number one job. So like to not think about it is really stupid. right? But I do think you should think about it. And I think you should set objectives and look around the ecosystem, like, what is it that I need to hit to be evaluated on a whole bunch of different axes by which time, and then revisit that on a regular basis, because as we saw, the ecosystem has shifted. So I do think a lot about, you know, if I want this valuation and raise this amount of money, what is it that I have to do to earn the right to get there? What are the metrics that I'm going to have to, with confidence, be able to demonstrate and show? And then back into, how do I get to those things? Well, how do I form my corporate objectives, right? To like get the path to when I need to get those. Timing is super critical in fundraising, right? Irrespective of market dynamics, you have to look at and think through when you want to be raising. What are the metrics to do that? And then pace yourself. We were just joking, right, earlier, like, you know, I think it's really important. Like, there are times as a CEO, like, you just have to put your head down and build the business. Like, it's nice that people want to talk to you. It's nice that investors want to tell you how smart you are and how, you know, deserving of their money you are, but like, actually put your head down and make the business work. And then all else falls into place. I think the other thing, and I'm sure this has been talked about in your show, but you don't build a business for an exit. You build a business to accomplish a mission, period. Like, the best entrepreneurs, when asked like what they want for their exit, they say they don't think about it because they're actually interested in solving a problem. All else will come into play. So in my mind, an IPO is no different than a series fundraise. It's just a fundraising mechanism, right? How do you use your fundraising mechanisms to get to scale? So if you're looking at an end goal point, the end goal point's like 100 years away, when like nobody in rural America has any healthcare issues. Like, that is our goal, right? So like, will there be a bunch of celebrations along the way? Absolutely. Will we have different fundraisers along the way, whether they be private or public? Absolutely. Right. But we are like laser focused. And will we reward our employees along the way? Absolutely. But like, the goal of the company is the mission of re-architecting healthcare delivery in rural America. That is right now focused on the U.S. But you can imagine there's a whole other world outside of that. Once we accomplish that in the U.S., like, I'm not done. Like, we got a lot of work in front.
See, that is the exact answer. So we talk a lot about startup building, but also angel investing and investments. That's the exact answer you want to hear from a CEO when you ask them, what's your exit strategy? Because I ask that all the time, right? You want to see what they say. And I was talking to another physician founder today, actually, the Abridge founder, Shiv. And I was like, I asked him something similar. And he's like, well, the whole point of this company is honestly to like make it easier to work in medicine. It's not necessarily to go have an exit. It's like, that's a fantastic answer. So completely agree with you. And going back to kind of just like your leadership, your executive leadership team and stuff like that, do you have other physicians that are around you, or are you the main physician voice, or do you have a chief medical officer?
We don't currently have a chief medical officer role. We have had physicians in the voice of the company. I am definitely more of a business leader than I am like a stellar chief medical officer, having not had that role for multiple years. And I have this sidebar belief that an excellent chief medical officer will likely not be a chief medical officer again, that their expanse and influence will grow beyond that, what's typically afforded there. But I do stay close to the product. I do stay close to the solution. I do stay close to like our caregiver group, because I care about what we're doing. And I have that training, which is useful, but it's not the way I think about myself or how I spend most of my time.
I'm guessing you're no longer practicing clinically at this point, given you're a CEO of a pretty large growing company.
I'm not, but I have up until just recently done some volunteering with medical students, because I do like to still be in the practice, be close to the delivery end, like that last mile, because you understand things so differently, like when you're actually in it, and experiencing it, you see things very differently. I don't have my own panel of patients. I would be terrible at being able to deliver consistency of care given the demands of the rest of the parts of the job that I have right now. But it's not to say that I won't go back. It's not to say that I'm done ever practicing. It's just saying right now, between raising three kids and running a company, I have a lot on my plate and I can only have X number of hours in a day. Sadly, that would be a great company.
Just a little busy.
10 hours in a day would be a great
last thing we'll have here in terms of like a section of the podcast is any plugs that you want to throw out there, either for the physician listeners or anything really in terms of advice or working with Homeward moving forward, anything like that.
Yeah, I think so. Relative to just other physicians, I think the ability, like, one, physicians are trained and the training is so unique and so special. and so valuable, and valuable beyond the ways that you're often asked to deploy it. And so I think pausing for a minute and saying, how else can you deploy not just the medical school training, but the interactions you have with the people and the systems in healthcare? And how can you think about doing things differently to fix those little bits and very large broken pieces? And then saying, look, the ownership is on you to do that and to develop an ecosystem that you like to work in, right? And so I think being motivated and understanding the responsibility of doing that on behalf of the profession is key and critical, whether that's starting a new company, large health system, payer, community, whatever that is. Like, I think thinking through that. The second is, I would say people that go into medicine are undaunted. Like, you don't go into medicine because you're nervous, right? And you're scared. And then we kind of come out and we become more conservative in the actions that we take to make things better. And so I would say still continue to lean in with why did you go into healthcare in the first place? And almost always it's to make a difference in X, Y, or Z, or delivery of care. And how can you do that more audaciously at scale? And then I think relative to Homeward, I think our business model is we partner with payers to own the total cost of care for individuals. And we also partner with providers and healthcare systems in the ecosystem because we're not competing. We're trying to work it all together and work it in a different manner so that it's plausible. And so as physicians are out there, have your ears and eyes open, not just like so that you can do a career change, but so that you can understand what's happening in the ecosystem around you that you can incorporate and fast forward in behalf of the community, in behalf of your members and your patients to make things better. I think I'm always puzzled. Like, I went to Hopkins. It was like the number one medical school, and I applied to medical school and I got no training in medical economics, no training in medical technology, but like the Oslarian method and this Krebs cycle, like I'm good with those things, but in a day-to-day practice, like those are not as relevant as some of the other pieces that we're missing. And so I think as an adult learner, we all go into medical school like because you must love school, or why else would you spend that many years there? Like you like learning, and so it's continuously learning. But the healthcare ecosystem has shifted in so many exciting ways to lean in and to continue to learn those pieces.
Yeah, it's always the thing that I say, like, physicians have a superpower, and is like, you're a lifelong learner, like from the start. Like, medical school just teaches you how to just sit down and learn. So you can always learn the business side of things, which is honestly the point of this podcast. Is I want more physicians building companies, and hopefully I can invest in some of them. Anyways, Jenny, thank you for so much for jumping on the show. And we would love to have you back in the future as you continue to scale things and see where you are in a couple of years. Any final things?
No, I just want to say I echo your words of I want more physicians in the pod as well, because that perspective is so incredibly valuable to what we're trying to do and is oftentimes not represented at scale the way we need it to be at scale.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that the information and opinions expressed on this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. Before making any investment decisions, we strongly recommend that you consult with your lawyer, tax professional, and financial planner. Keep in mind that investing in startups can be extremely risky, and there's a potential for loss of your entire investment. Remember to always conduct thorough research and consider your risk tolerance before making any financial decisions. Stay informed, and we look forward to having you join us on our next episode of the Physician Syndicate Podcast.